Welcome to Real World Rewind, a monthly podcast where we take a look at some of our favorite movies from years gone by, reminding ourselves that entertainment is not mindless. Now, since it's October, we're going to get spooky with it for this month's episode, and we're going to talk about Carl Theodor Dreyer's Vampyr. And to help me talk about this movie, I'm bringing in someone who just is the embodiment of spooky and creepy, and that's my friend, Blake Collier. Hey, Blake.
How's it going?
I can joke with Blake like that and say that he's creepy because we actually know each other in real life.
Yeah.
So I get to do that.
IRL, buddy.
Yeah, IRL. So Vampyr is directed by Carl Theodor Dreyer. It was released in 1932. And it was preceded by Murnau's Nosferatu and the Bela Lugosi Dracula. So, Blake, can you flesh out a little bit of the historical context of Vampyr in a little bit greater detail since you're a historian?
Oh, man, nice. Well, I'll try to give you a little bit. I can't go terribly in-depth because I don't know exactly the context of, this film within the historical context of the time and the place he was at, but I can kind of give you a hint as to kind of where it fits within the scope of horror history. So, like you said, this is after Dracula, Universal's Dracula, and after Nosferatu, both of which are considered classics of early horror. I actually found this one much later in life. I had never really heard of it, and I found it on, I believe it was Netflix, and I watched it, and I was just blown away by the film. So when I realized that it was actually within the same kind of time period as those two films that I'd already seen multiple times, I started kind of digging in, and the interesting thing about Vampyr is that it's in that weird crossover time between silent and talky films.
Yeah.
It's so unlike Dracula, which looks and feels very much like a modern talky film. It has this kind of rawness that kind of makes it feel like it might have actually happened before Dracula. It doesn't look as I guess you could say cohesive in the sound and how it matches up with audio or with the visuals. So it's very interesting to see that it kind of came after after Dracula, because it does feel a little older than that. It's interesting because I think a lot of the modern version that we have seen is pretty much compiled by a bunch of parts. Because some of the footage was lost, some of it was burned. So a couple of, I believe it was German and I want to say Swiss?
French.
Companies that came... French? Okay. I came together and reworked a lot of the footage and kind of timed it and gave it audio and were able to give enough of the footage to create a reasonably cohesive narrative. That seems to be pretty much the norm for those days. Most of the films you find from those days are pretty much done in that format because they didn't understand how to properly keep film without it destroying itself. So, it's a very strange kind of phenomena within the early days of horror in that it should be a lot clearer in visuals, like in the cinematography, and it should be a lot more, I guess the visuals and audio should be tied in more, mm-hmm. but they aren't. So it's weird in that sense, just because it feels like it's late 20s and it's actually early 30s. So, yeah, I mean, within the scope of vampire films, though, I believe this one actually may be the one I think is most important from that time period, even though it's the lesser known of the first three of those. Mainly because it has a visual sense and a technical quality that you can't really find in Universal's Dracula or in Nosferatu. Even Nosferatu has some great scenes, some very creepy scenes, but it doesn't have kind of the prowess that Vampyr does. And I think that's what really makes Vampyr special, is just how audacious Dreyer was in making this film with the lack of technology that we have today. And he's able to create some atmosphere and create some visuals that are just stunning. And even with, you know, less than clear quality film, they come off almost in a dreamlike state, and it's fabulous.
Yeah, I think you hit on something that we're going to dive into deeper a little bit later on, is the technical quality and some of the formal elements that Dreyer uses that, in my mind as well, makes this the standout movie among the three that are around and popular in this time: Nosferatu, Dracula, and then Vampyr. And actually, Vampyr was, not only is it probably the least known today just on an international level, but it was also critically panned upon its release as well, and actually performed so poorly that Dreyer had to go and work again as a journalist for a little while after this film premiered to be able to get funding and be able to convince people to let him make a movie again 5 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not well received upon its release. And I think another thing you mentioned that stuck out to me, even rewatching this film, was that it very much works on and operates on a silent aesthetic, even though, like you said, it's very much working in the era of I mean, it is a talkie, and it's coming firmly in that era. But one of the things that contributed to that silent aesthetic that Dreyer uses is that they had to record dialogue in three different languages, German, mm-hmm. French, and English. And they did that in post-production, and that required a lot of work. So actually, Dreyer was trying intentionally to keep the dialogue to a minimum, if for no other reason than that it was going to save them work in post-production and make things less difficult and, most importantly, less expensive when you're talking about getting funding.
Well, and you would have to reshoot all the scenes with them speaking in different languages so that they could match the audio properly, and that's going to take money too.
Yeah,
For sure. But you know, I feel like the lack of dialogue actually adds to the film's aesthetic overall. I think that's what appeals to me. Nosferatu kind of fits in that same category, and that it's completely silent. But I feel like Nosferatu, once you really get past the first viewing of it, which is always usually fairly astounding for most people, mm-hmm. If you watch it again and again, it kind of loses a little bit of its, quality, its spookiness. Vampyr never does lose that, and I think that's because Dreyer is the better director of the two. So,
yeah, and I think it's also worth noting that this that Vampyr is loosely, very, very, very loosely based off of a story written by Sheridan Le Fanu, and the book was a collection of five short stories, Vampyr is based off of one of them. Again, very, very, very loosely. I mean, there's almost no sense in which it's a traditional adaptation. It's almost like he's pulling themes or ideas broadly to adapt. But the film's very visually expressive. It relies little on dialogue. Another thing historically, I think, that is significant about that is that this film is very much influenced by German Expressionism and German Expressionist films like those of Murnau, who's a contemporary of Dreyer. And so German Expressionism, in its at least in its filmic manifestations, you see films that emphasize stark contrasts between light and dark. You see very unique, distorted camera angles. You'll see an emphasis on architecture and particularly sharp or unusual angles in architectural structures.
Mm-hmm.
And this is supposed to disorient the viewer or give them a sense of...
Maybe detach them a little bit from the reality that they know.
Yeah. Vampyr is a very dense movie, and one of the central themes that I picked up on is this blurring of subjectivity and objectivity. In other words, it's really difficult in this film to determine what's real, what's really going on, mm-hmm. and what is imagined. In fact, Dreyer himself has spoken about how much he likes to use or instill his films with a sense of ambiguity. And so I'm going to actually read a quote from Dreyer. It's a little lengthy, but I think it's worth quoting at length. And he's actually talking about the Passion of Joan of Arc in this quote. But I think this applies to Vampyr very well. So here it is. Dreyer says, "Where is the possibility of artistic renewal in the cinema? I can only answer for myself, and I can only see one way, abstraction. In order to not be misunderstood, I must at once define abstraction as something that demands of the artist to abstract himself from reality in order to strengthen the spiritual content of his work. More concisely, the artist must describe inner, not outer life. The capacity to abstract is essential to all artistic creation. Abstraction allows the director to get outside of the fence with which naturalism has surrounded his medium. It allows him to be, it allows his films to be not merely visual, but spiritual. The director must share his own artistic and spiritual experiences with the audiences. Abstraction will give him a chance of doing it, of replacing objective reality with his own subjective interpretation." And I think we see that borne out in this film and in a lot of Dreyer's cinema. So yeah. My question for you then is, what does Dreyer do in this film to introduce ambiguity and destabilize our perceptions as viewers?
Well, I think the part that probably, for me, marks the moment where reality and kind of this other world start to meld is whenever he gets up from this manor where he's staying, and he goes out to this, I guess it's a house or a decrepit building, basically. And he goes in, and there's he sees inverted or upside down or reversed shadows, mm-hmm. that are dancing around. There's a soldier with a peg leg who is walking around. There's a guy digging dirt, or rather it's done in reverse. So he's actually bringing the dirt from the pile, and it's hitting a shovel and going back into the hole. So it's the exact opposite of what you would expect to see from a shadow. And so you see all this shadow play going on here in this building, and he's witnessing this. And at that point, the viewer, at least for me, I'm looking at that, I'm like, okay, so what are we supposed to,
right?
What are we supposed to believe about what's going on right now? Because, like you said, dialogue is very spare, and there's really not that much information given up till that point. So, are we just the only thing we really have to go on is that we know that Alan West, our protagonist, is a fan of the occult. He studies it. He wanders around aimlessly, I believe the words say, finding just new things to uncover. And he comes upon this town, Corten Pier, and he finds himself in a situation. He's like, I would feel like this is something he would expect to see. And so maybe the audience should expect to see something like this. But it's so disorienting, like you said, with the visuals and with just the way he's able to use those shadows to kind of buck up against our conceptions of what shadows do and how shadows can exist in a world where there is no object to shadow off of. So at that point, I think that's the point where you're having to do a lot of work as a viewer to kind of read into what Dreyer is trying to tell us and or trying to drive the narrative. And it is confusing as all get out.
Yeah, it's very confusing. Yeah, the shadowy figures that they don't have any discernible reality, but then they go and they rejoin the bodies that they're attached to. I'm thinking of the soldier with the peg leg. Mm-hmm. It's very bizarre, very disorienting, especially on a first viewing. Or you think about the guy, like you also, I believe, mentioned the grave undigger.
Yeah.
So yeah, things are going in opposite directions. There's also a lot of there are a number of intertitles in this film, especially in the first half of the film. You see a lot of intertitle cards, and there are actually images behind these intertitle cards, where we read the text, but there's images behind them. Yeah. And I think these images themselves emphasize the idea that what we think we're seeing may not be what's actually happening. Or that it throws into question the idea that we know exactly what's going on. So one of the images behind the intertitle card is a spider web. That's the one that always sticks out to me. It's like this idea that Gray may be walking into a trap.
Yeah.
By the way, when you mentioned the protagonist, you said his name was Alan West. Is that the print of the film that you're watching?
Yeah, I believe so. Let me see. Oh, Alan Gray. No, I had it wrong.
Okay.
His name is Julian West. So his real name. So
that makes sense. I do know in one of the early cuts of the films that his name was something different. So I didn't know.
Okay.
Different cuts.
I transpose their names.
But yeah, I think I see Dreyer introducing ambiguity on two levels primarily. This is somewhat of an oversimplification, but he's introducing ambiguity on a narrative level and on a formal level. And you've hit on a lot of these things that the narrative is doing to introduce ambiguity. You've got intertitles, you've got all of these shadows, and the shadows are very strange. But also on a structural level. So in addition to the narrative things that are going on a structural or a formal level, Dreyer made use of some very interesting formal innovations that are deliberately intended to disorient and confuse the viewer and introduce those moments of ambiguity. So, for instance, Dreyer is a big fan of unconventional framing techniques. You would have these canted angles. You would have angles that seem like they're from a character's point of view, but then they turn out not to be. It turns out to be physically impossible for these angles to be coming from a person's point of view. Or then you do have point of view shots, but they're coming from someone who is, you know, supposedly deceased, something like that. Like we do with Alan Gray. But you also have very interesting editing and cutting techniques. Dreyer's camera pans and tracks with a lot of freedom, almost like it has a mind of its own in this movie. And these characters move in and out of the frame in very mysterious ways. So there's a scene where a nurse is attending to Leon as she lays sick in bed. And the nurse starts out on the left side of the bed. And we're watching the nurse attend to Leon. And then the camera tracks over to the door. And then all of a sudden, tracks over to the right to the door. And then all of a sudden, we see the nurse reemerge on the right side of the door and go out the door. I mean, it's easy for us to assume that she walked around behind the camera and got out on the other side, but that's a very unconventional editing technique.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you wanted to add? I thought I heard you try to jump in there.
No. I was agreeing to the odd moments there, and you know, to kind of on the shallow end of that, one could say, well, he just made a mistake. But I feel like Dreyer's not that kind of director. I feel like everything he does is there for a reason, and he's playing with your mind. Like, he's playing with how you understand the world to work, like directionally, positionally. You know, the fact that this woman's on one side and then all of a sudden we're assuming she's going around the camera coming to the other side, or we just think that that's just how this world works, this ambiguous world works, is that she can move in a way that defies what we understand to be a realistic movement.
Yeah.
And I feel like that actually plays into, once again, the ambiguity of the narrative and kind of the visuals, is that once we hit what I consider to be the part where he sees the shadows, from that point on, I would defy anyone to be able to pick out perfectly what's actually real and what's a dream and what's other. And so, because it's a big tangle past that point. And really, at that point, as a viewer, you just have to go with it. You have to let it wash over you and watch it several times. I've probably seen this movie 4 or 5 times now. And I still probably couldn't tell you exactly what is going on. Even the ending to this day, like I feel like I have a better sense abstractly of what's going on.
Yeah.
But I still couldn't explain it.
So. Yeah. If you really want to challenge yourself, just try doing a plot synopsis of this movie. It's difficult.
It's difficult. Yeah, it's very difficult.
Yeah, there's also that scene when we talk about camera movement and characters moving mysteriously. There's a scene where Gray's going up into the attic. This is early on in the film. And he lifts up the attic door, and camera's positioned from a higher angle looking down on him. And then it starts to pan off to the right, and we see this coffin that we're assuming, or that I assumed at least, I guess that's the better way to put it, that this is the coffin the doctor's living, sleeping in. But the camera pans off to the right, and so we expect Gray to be there and be looking at the coffin. But then the camera lifts up and pans over to the left, and we see Gray way down the hallway. He's walking in the completely the other direction.
Yeah.
That's really disorienting. And it's especially disorienting because by this time in cinema history, conventional editing patterns had been established, especially in Hollywood. Hollywood relied on editing patterns that we put under the umbrella of continuity editing.
Yeah.
In other words, the idea is in Hollywood films, films are edited in a way where actions and scenes and the plot is supposed to move in a straightforward linear way with a straightforward cause and effect sequence of events. But Dreyer is completely resisting that trend. So, for instance, one of the elements of continuity editing is inside-out editing patterns in a scene. So, for instance, if you look at any Hollywood movie, even today, if you look at any major Hollywood movie, they're going to follow these patterns pretty much. You will start a scene with an establishing shot, which is usually a fuller shot, wide-angle shot, something maybe of the outside of a building or of a place a character's going into or of all the characters who are about to be in this scene. And then we'll move slowly in. You'll maybe see a medium shot, right, of these two characters who are about to talk. And then we'll move very, very close, and we'll see just their faces. And then we'll go into a shot, counter shot editing pattern where they have this conversation. You do not see that at all in Dreyer's film. He does exactly the opposite. And so these lack of formal conventions, especially for American viewers, both in the 30s and now, this is a very disorienting experience if you're not used to someone who, a filmmaker who deliberately bucks these trends. He rejects this, he rejects continuity editing. Another example of this is if you look at the end of the film, when Gray and Giselle are going off in the canoe, they're going off together, running away. They enter from screen right and go to screen left and get in the canoe and keep going left in their boat across the lake. And then the next time we see them, there's a cutaway shot or some cutaway scenes. And then when we see them again, they enter on the right of the they enter on the left of the frame and then start and then are moving right.
Yeah.
Which is the opposite of what we would expect. We would expect them to continue going from right to left, but they don't do that. The direction changes. So that's just another example of ways Dreyer is messing with his viewers.
No doubt. Well, and it's you add on to the fact that in general, most American viewers have a hard enough time watching black and white films. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's a whole nother interesting topic. At some point, you could say that, watching black and white films or watching films that are far removed from your time period takes a little bit of disorientation and I guess a mixture, a blending of what you understand reality is of as of now and what reality was then. And you have to almost lose, you have to drop the pretense of your own understanding of reality in order to appreciate black and white film. And then the fact that Carl Dreyer comes along and refuses to be, you know, to do these edits in a way that Hollywood had done, you know, continuity edits, just makes it that much worse.
Yeah.
Because we're completely shut off from any kind of sense of understanding, at least within the West and America especially. He's intentionally being difficult because he wants us to lose ourselves in this. Like he I think this is a movie that he wanted to make to let it soak in our mind. I don't think this is a movie that necessarily needs to have this perfect narrative summary or anything like that. I think it's just something that we need to feel. And I think that I haven't gotten the chance to see any of his other work, but I've heard that that's pretty similar throughout his all of his films, that there's a sense of more attention to, I guess, emotion and how we relate to the films instead of the actual content of what's going on. So,
yeah, that seems fair from my exposure to Dreyer. So Dreyer is an interesting filmmaker also because if you know me at all, which Blake does, for everyone else, I'm a big fan of Nordic cinema. And when I tell people that, the first thing most people say to me is, oh, Dreyer, or oh, Bergman. Mm-hmm. And so Dreyer is an interesting, and Bergman as well, actually, but Dreyer and Bergman are interesting characters because, again, they're not working at all within the Hollywood system, which makes sense because they're not American filmmakers. But so they're certainly not American filmmakers, but they are. Dreyer and Bergman are both Nordic filmmakers who are probably the most palatable to or amenable to international palates.
Yes.
That makes sense. So it's kind of this weird in-between space, which actually fits with the type of movies that Dreyer and Bergman made. And I think on a related note, it's interesting for me, especially to think about how Dreyer was a contemporary to Sergei Eisenstein. And in a way, Dreyer's editing practices were in some sense very antithetical to Eisenstein. So for instance, if you're a fan of Eisenstein, you know that Eisenstein was all about montage, and he is a creator of the montage theory. And so in Eisenstein's understanding, and this is simplifying quite a bit, but for Eisenstein and his montage theory, Eisenstein said that meaning does not reside in individual shots in a film themselves, but meaning exists, or meaning is created in the relationships among the shots. In other words, shots take on meaning or are given meaning when they're placed in relationship to other shots that help promote a sense of what Eisenstein called organic unity throughout the entire work. So the most famous example of this is from Eisenstein's Odessa Steps sequence from Battleship Potemkin. And just a very easy example is the lion at the very end of the Odessa Steps sequence. There are three very, very quick shots, sequential shots of a statue of a lion. In the first one, the lion is laying down. In the second one, the lion is starting to get up. And then in the third one, he's fully awakened. And that symbolized the uprising of the proletariat workers there, or citizens. But Dreyer completely resists that as well. So for instance, Dreyer's shots don't match. They don't work together like this. They don't always help us see character motivations. So many of these shots in Dreyer's films, it seems to me, are just there to create a certain tempo or an atmosphere, like you said, just to help us soak in this environment that's very, very disorienting.
Yeah, for sure.
But, and I think this is going to serve as a good segue, I think there's an interesting and pretty remarkable exception to this. Near the film's climax, Gray, we see three different Alan Grays introduced, as if it wasn't confusing enough already.
Yeah.
but we have Gray, the one we are assuming is real, Gray, the character we've been following the whole time, he sits down on a bench. And then Gray's shadow separates himself from the Gray on the bench, and goes walking around. That's actually the Gray, the shadow Gray, is the one who discovers Giselle tied up. She's been kidnapped by the vampire. And then we see Gray's corpse in a coffin. So we see a dead Gray. So we've got these three Grays going around. And then the narrative focuses on that corpse in the coffin, the Alan Gray in the coffin. And we get a subjective point of view from inside the coffin. So we're looking at things from Gray's perspective, laying down in the coffin, looking up through the little window in the coffin. But here, we start to see more continuity for the first time in the film. So the cutaways start to reduce. Shots start to match thematically and visually. And then eventually, of course, the coffin vanishes mysteriously in the park. And the Gray who's sitting on the bench is reanimated, so the narrative can proceed as normal. And then we start to see the reintroduction of these ambiguous filmmaking techniques again, which is just a really, really fascinating thing.
Yeah, no doubt.
But while we're talking about those things, people dying, vampires kidnapping people, let's talk a little bit about the religious themes and imagery, or maybe even lack thereof, in key moments here. How do you see Dreyer playing with religious imagery in this film?
You know, that's interesting, because I remember one of the things that caught my attention this time was one of the background images on the cutaway, on the parts where they're given exposition.
Yeah.
One of them is a cross.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd never noticed that before. So I was looking at it, I was like, really, like, for the whole film, I don't really ever see a strong sense of imagery for religion, at least in the strict sense, what we would kind of consider to be overt imagery within films, modern day films. I feel like the closest we get to like really religious imagery is dealing with death, or at least a spiritual death, if not a physical death. Because, like I said, you know, going back to the parts wherever the ambiguity starts, there's an interplay between spirits and physical, the physical reality.
Mm-hmm.
So, we recognize that we are now entering into a world where there is no separation between natural and supernatural. It's all natural, like in the sense that it's all real, it's all seen, it's all sensed, so it's all natural. And this is just a part of the reality of the film. And it's interesting that the end, one of the final scenes you see is this picture of Gray in a coffin, which has the coffin itself has a lot of ties to Christian tradition, dealing with the rites of death, last rites, things like that. So I feel like, though, as a whole, I mean, one can make the case that I think you mentioned last night while we were texting each other that you didn't see a whole lot of religious imagery towards the end of the film. And I agree with that. I hadn't really thought about it until you mentioned it. But I find that interesting if you kind of tie that in with what you're talking about with the continuity of the film and where it hits that point where it becomes it actually starts connecting in a way that we understand. I feel like that's when the lack of religion happens. And I feel like you could almost make a case that Dreyer is saying that the ambiguity and the confusion that happens before is still within this religious milieu of influence. And it's not until we lose that religious element that things start to become, I guess you could say, the continuity stands, like it starts to make sense.
Yeah.
But then, like you said, again, that same, the lack of continuity comes back. And so maybe he's saying, but with the loss of religion, if we're looking at this only as materialistic things, there's things out there that we can't completely understand within that context. And so we find ourselves back in the ambiguity. I think that's just speculation, but I think that's an interesting kind of way you could process how he's looking at religion through this film. I think it's very subtle when he does use it. And it almost comes out of nowhere, like the cross, the shot of the cross. It's very interesting. I wouldn't say it's very straightforward at all. I think you have to dig a little deeper. You have to engage your imagination, be a little bit more speculative in kind of reading religious imagery and religious kind of topics into the film.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think you pointed out something really interesting. It's like Dreyer, again, is working in a way that's backwards from the way we think he should because of the narrative conventions of vampire stories. I think we see a decent amount of religious imagery in the beginning. I mean, you got the cross on the back of the inner tower. I mean, it's not overwhelming, but it's there.
Yeah.
Well, I think we see a couple of other crosses projected, but there's some religious imagery there. So we're expecting, as the narrative builds, and also as we have more of these inner titles that then sort of transform into us reading the book that Gray finds that the old man left for him. As Gray's reading this book, we expect to read about how you've got to have this cross and drive us, and we do learn that you have to drive a stake through the heart of the vampire to kill them. But you expect this religious imagery to amp up because this is what we expect from vampire stories. And also because Dreyer was a Nordic Protestant who was obviously very, very interested, and I say obviously because of his other films, very, very interested in exploring religious and spiritual themes and motifs in his films. Like, this is something that Dreyer does all the time. So then in Vampire, which is a film you would think would be really, really ripe for that kind of exploration, he pulls away from that. So yeah, it's a really interesting juke that he pulls on us. It's certain this is a movie that certainly doesn't lend itself to Jesus juking.
For sure. And it moves away from a lot of the problem of much modern cinema is that he refuses to have a triumphalism of a religious or Christian values at the end of the film. He's not concerned with that. He's concerned with this world and how religion transcends into this world. But the reality of the situation is that religion doesn't always win. Like, the iconography of religion, of Christianity especially, it's there, and it will always be in the background. It will always be present, but it's not always going to triumph.
Yeah.
And whereas much of religious imagery in most cinema throughout time, there is a sense of a triumphalism of religious values, of religious heroes. And especially with possession films, if you're talking horror, that's ripe for Christian triumphalism.
Mm-hmm.
The good priest overcomes the satanic influence. That's why movies like Vampire and The Exorcist are so upsetting, is because that triumphalism is intentionally moved to the side.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, no, we don't always find ourselves in that position. And sometimes triumphalism actually gets in the way of actually legitimate religious affection. So,
yeah, it's interesting in light of all this. It still seems to me that Vampire is deeply, deeply resonant with the Christian faith in a very real way, because, and you hit on this, the thing that sticks out to me most about this film is how it highlights the fundamental entanglement of the natural and the spiritual into one narrative.
Yeah.
So in other words, we're always questioning, is this really happening, or is this just is this reality, or is this just fantasy?
Yeah. Exactly.
So and at the end, like, this movie shows that the so-called natural world, the so-called realistic world, is in fact a mysterious and a spooky and a supernatural place. That seems to me to be very, very resonant with the Christian faith, where our entire faith is built around a historical event that's identifiable, right? There was this man who actually lived. You can look at the history books. This man actually lived. He actually died, and so far so good, right? That seems we've heard those stories all the time. And then this guy, 3 days later, gets back up from being dead and starts walking around and doing miracles and seeing all of these people. And then he goes up into heaven, and he's coming back. So we've got that's what the Christian faith is. The Christian faith is this fundamental entanglement of natural and supernatural.
Yeah, exactly.
One narrative. So, like, this seems really resonant to me with the Christian faith, but in a very, very genuine way. Not, like you said, not necessarily in a forced way that may be one of the issues with modern horror. I think you and I are both fans also of Let the Right One In, Thomas Alfredson.
Very much so.
Which is also a very pessimistic, or, you know, well, it's a much more pessimistic, or yes, can be read much. As a much more pessimistic vampire narrative. That also is notable for its absence of religious imagery.
Yes.
So yeah, that's one to check out too. There's an American remake, which is called, what is it called?
Let Me In.
Let Me In, which, yeah.
It's interesting in parts. It's largely interesting in the way the director, and I can't remember his name, really sets the story within 80s America.
Mm-hmm.
So Reagan is everywhere in that movie. Like a lot of this retro feel to the movie is all around. And that's really the best part of that movie. Overall, I'm not a fan of the film. I just find that his setting is really interesting. But it's nothing like the original. So.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. It seems like the American remake is a much more sanitized,
yes,
version, because there is in that film has some deeply, deeply disturbing and subtle, sexual subtext.
Yes.
It's like, it's some of the most unsettling subtext I've encountered in a film. It still shakes me every time I think about it.
And it has one of the greatest scenes, of violence that feels almost, artistically beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, it's the one of the few times I've seen a film that can pull that off, like with such, just gratuitous violence, but done in a way that it is just gorgeous.
Yeah.
Which is so weird to me.
Yeah,
so.
Take note, Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely agree. So yeah, the little mini-sode on Let the Right One In.
There you go.
But I do love that movie. And it's also relevant because I think it draws from Vampyr in some sense, and that it's subverting what we expect from a vampire story. You also have this idea, like the doctor who's in cahoots with the vampire. He's the one who's defeated at the end, not the vampire in this movie, which is just not what we would expect. And the house servant is the one who kills the vampire.
Yeah.
Not Gray. So we just have these very unusual sorts of, conclusions.
It's almost humorous because Gray almost feels like an anti-protagonist.
Yeah.
Because really, if you really stand back and look at what he's done in the film, he really hasn't done that much.
Yeah. That's very true. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He's mostly just been watching and got to, you know. He doesn't even. It's his shadow that discovers Giselle tied up at the end.
Yep.
It's not even.
That's right. I mean, it's not even him.
Is that him or whatever? But yeah, so he's a very interesting protagonist. Also, isn't it interesting to you, or was it surprising to you when you watched this movie for the first time? It's called Vampyr. It's supposedly about a vampire. We maybe see the vampire for a minute, two, maybe.
Yeah.
I feel like that may even be pushing it. That was surprising to me the very first time I watched this film. And it's also, the vampire is introduced in a way where it's not just this very obvious, oh, here's the vampire. We see her crouching over Leon in the park. You know, just having bitten her, but we don't actually see the act or anything like that. That was shocking to me.
Oh, for sure. And it almost feels like the vampire is such a backstory to the whole film.
Yeah.
It really doesn't even feel like a significant part of the narrative drive, except for the parts where we're reading along with the characters as they read in the occult book, the older gentleman of the house gives Gray. And so really, like, I was paying attention to those segments of writing that they're reading, and there's really not, like, it's your typical vampire kind of mythology that you're reading in this thing. There's really nothing new going on there, but I think it's interesting that he's giving this exposition, even though really the story surrounds this like very almost dreamlike state that this film is kind of showing. It has, you see the vampire, you see the effects of the vampire, but it's almost like the vampire is that ambiguity and not really a person.
Yeah.
So.
It certainly does. There's also something I wanted to ask you about. And near the beginning of the film, when Gray first goes to the inn, he hears something at night, gets out of his room, and he sees a man in the hallway that just has this distorted face.
Yeah.
So my question to you is, what the heck? because that's never picked. I mean, there are many things like this in this film, like that's something never picked up on again. That's a thread that's just kind of there.
I feel like there's probably a couple of those areas. I feel like in the first parts of the movie, when you see the man with the scythe, you see the bell being rung, you see a bunch of, like, they almost feel like pieced together imagery.
Yeah.
Just at the very beginning, like, you see a man, he's almost a shadow himself, because he's all dressed in black and he's carrying the scythe. And you're just watching him. And the scythe is, it's an image of death. It's like something that everyone recognizes as kind of the Reaper. And so you're already kind of put off by that imagery, because you're like, oh, that's supposed to symbolize something that's probably going to be coming. There's going to be an element of death going on here. And then you have the guy with the distorted face, and it just feels, I just feel like he's putting that in there to add to the ambiguity, to add to the disorientation, but he's also doing that in a way to really build a very suffocating atmosphere. This is almost kind of it's like a melding of a nightmare and a dream world.
It's
wild.
And then you have that wonderful bit at the end where the doctor gets killed by being drowned by flour.
Yeah, was that flour or was that cocaine?
Yeah.
I couldn't tell.
And he, the door, like, what closes the door? The door closes on him in there and locks him in. And then the gears start turning mysteriously, but we don't know who or what closed the door or started the gears turning. So there's all of these unanswered questions. This is a movie that is not very concerned with handing you things, which I think relates back to that Dreyer quote that I brought out earlier. Dreyer very much wants to instill a sense of ambiguity in his films and cause us to question these things that we're seeing.
For sure.
So any last thoughts you have on this?
No, I think this is one of the films that I consider to be on my list of all-time favorite horror films. Yeah. It's one that keeps on giving, while at the same time just becoming more and more confusing the more I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And but I feel like it's a lost treasure, and I think that that's one of those films that doesn't get enough play, doesn't get enough critical, I guess, writing done on it. And maybe you and I can collaborate on that.
Yeah, that'd be a lot of fun. So it's October. This is your month.
Yes.
I feel like the ghosts and the goblins are out. You're out and you're active all the time writing places, but you're really active in Halloween.
Yes.
So I feel like I want to give you a few minutes to plug what you've got going on social media this Halloween season.
So I will be writing an article a week for Real World Theology, part of the Oh, the Horror series. Two of those pieces will be previously written stuff that I had on my own personal blog that I'm repurposing for y'all's site. And then outside of that, I will be doing a collaboration with Ian Olson, who is a co-host of mine with The Body of the Blood over at Mockingbird, mbird.com. We're going to do kind of take turns each week of October, and we're going to do a top five list of something Halloween related. And then the other person will comment on that list. And then outside of that, I believe I've got a review of the classics for you guys as well. I'm going to be doing Sliver. No, not Sliver. Yeah, Sliver. Yeah. And then let's see what else. Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, you can catch all my ramblings on Twitter constantly. Sometimes they're horror related. Sometimes they're not. Just depends.
Yeah. Make sure you check out all that stuff. Blake's going to be really active. Also, you brought Ian Olson up.
Yes.
You and Ian Olson worked together a couple of years ago, and actually Ian wrote the main piece, and then you responded to it.
Yes.
And it was actually on Vampyr, and I'm going to link to that in the show notes. I highly recommend that all of you who are listening check that out, because it's beautiful. Beautiful writing, and it will really help you. If not understand the film more, it will help you appreciate it more.
For sure.
I don't think that you can understand this film this film.
No, yeah.
But it will make you appreciate it more. So thanks for coming on, Blake. It was,
yeah, for sure.
It was
good. Thank you for having me. With you.
Yeah. Thanks to everyone who listened. You can find me on Twitter. Find me writing on Real World Theology and over at Christ and Pop Culture. So until next time, thanks for rewinding with us. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!